we're opening Pandora's box on an issue that the community said, we don't want that box open.
Bethel debates another proposal that would make alcohol more accessible in the community. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 13th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Denali claims a climber's life.
There are aspects to what occurred on the mountain that we won't really know till we can fully debrief the actual participants.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
One climber is dead and three others injured in an accident in a windstorm near the 20,000-foot summit of Denali. The climbers were part of a team that suffered a fall high on the mountain early Thursday. The group's guide and one client suffered frostbite but made it to a camp at 17,000 feet. National Park Service spokeswoman Maureen McLaughlin says 70-mile-an-hour winds kept rangers from launching a helicopter mission to rescue the other two climbers until 5 p.m. Thursday. McLaughlin says a climber who suffered a broken leg was picked up near the mountain's 19,500-foot level.
We used a short-haul rescue basket. So the individual was able to crawl into that basket and then was short-hauled down to the 7,200-foot base camp and put on an air ambulance for further medical care.
McLaughlin says the man suffered severe frostbite and hypothermia as well as the broken leg. She says the helicopter returned to get the other climber who was found unresponsive near the 18,000-foot level of Denali.
Ranger Kevin Wright was on the end of a short haul line and clipped into that individual, and he was short hauled down to base camp as well. And it was obvious at that point that climber had succumbed to his injuries.
McLaughlin says the cause of death is unknown, but the climber did not appear to have suffered any trauma. She says the mountaineers spent 24 hours exposed to high winds and temperatures that dipped to minus 30 degrees. The names of the climbers are being withheld until their families are notified. APRN has confirmation from Mountain Trip Guides co-owner Todd Rutledge that the guide involved in the Denali accident is Dave Stahaley, an experienced climbing guide since 1979. Mountain Trip is based in Ophir, Colorado.
Dave is most likely the most experienced Denali guide working on the mountain today. He's been guiding on Denali since 1982 and has been a mentor to a lot of the guides that are employed nowadays.
Rutledge is on his way to Alaska at this hour. The death was the first on Denali this season. Another climber died in an ice fall on the nearby Ruth Glacier last month. Evacuees returned to flood-damaged Crooked Creek today after spending days at the nearby Donlin Creek gold mine site. Although they're back in the village, they can't go back to their homes because the dangers of floodwaters are still present. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports.
About 4 days after floodwater invaded the village, the ice jam released a few miles downriver. Water has receded, but Crooked Creek remained under a flood warning through Friday. Ben Bach is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service.
There still was a little bit of water on the road that leads to the bridge between the airport and the front street.
It's estimated that floodwaters rose a total of about 30 feet in the village.
People are still pretty shocked. The reality of the situation has not set in.
Evelyn Thomas is the village tribal administrator.
My own grandchildren that live with me are saying, well, I'll go home and get this. And I'm having a hard time getting them to understand that we have no home to go home to get this.
Last Sunday night when the waters rose, Thomas was instrumental in getting residents to higher ground. It was about 3 a.m. when she gathered at-risk people in the second story of a general store. She says residents prepared for breakup as they do every year, but the flood came so fast there was little they could do.
This happened so quickly that the stuff that we prepared, the boats with the tents and the food and the water in them, we had no time to get to them.
In her own assessment, Thomas believes at least 24 homes could be totaled.
Either foundation damage, off the foundation completely, floated away, smashed. My concern now is when everybody wants to come back and begin working and seeing what they can, you know, what their homes are like and everything else is, I'm afraid of E. coli, waterborne diseases.
Because there's still some water there, it's difficult to get a good assessment of the contamination that took place from the flood.
Brian Lefferts is the environmental health director with the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. He says there could be a variety of contaminants.
We're looking for possibly spilt fuels and then just sort of any other natural contamination that comes with floodwaters.
The state put the village on a boil water notice as a precautionary measure. YKHC has tested the village's main well, and Lefferts says they should have those results tonight.
If they're negative for coliform bacteria, the state should be able to lift the boil water notice.
YKHC has been working with the state and federal response teams to bring in needed supplies. The Health Corporation has also placed two registered nurses in the village. Meanwhile, the Riverwatch team is now focused on flood threats the next 100 miles of the river, especially the village of Aniak, which is about 50 miles down from Crooked Creek. Box says it's part of the effects from the November breakup and refreeze.
The ice is very unusual this year with the Thanksgiving ice run that has really locked up and caused some really strong ice in different places. And so we expect that the likelihood of ice jam forming just below Aniak is pretty high this year.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The biggest alcohol chain in the state is proposing to sell directly to customers in Bethel. It's the first move by an outside business to try and set up shop in the Western Alaska city since residents voted to revoke its alcohol restrictions. But the Bethel City Council is trying to stop the plan. From member station KYUK, Shane Iverson reports.
The Brown Jug has been shipping alcohol to Bethel customers for decades, but now that Bethel is an unrestricted alcohol community, they'd like to move in a little closer. The Brown Jug is proposing a unique plan. They want a storefront and sales rep in Bethel, but the store would not actually stock alcohol. Instead, the sales rep would send orders to their warehouse in Anchorage. But at Bethel City Council's last meeting, Mayor Eric Middlebrook said the city should protest the plan.
I really don't want to see Brown Jug move forward with this proposal.
The Brown Jug has not yet submitted a liquor license application, but according to City Clerk Lori Strickler, the state's Alcohol Beverage Control Board is requesting immediate direction from the council. Mayor Eric Middlebrook.
I think that in a way the ABC board is to asking us to reaffirm our resolve that we had when we had the advisory vote.
That vote, taken almost a year and a half ago, made it clear that Bethel did not support the issuance of liquor licenses, even though the same residents had just voted to unrestrict alcohol. That advisory vote compelled the ABC board to deny half a dozen liquor license applications already. Again, Eric Middlebrook.
If we start wavering on that, there's going to be cracks in that solidarity.
The only council member to vote against the protest was council member Tundy Rogers.
The orders are going to go in no matter which way you go. These guys want to make sure that the people that are ordering booze are not the wrong ones to help us control alcohol.
But Vice Mayor Thor Williams told the council to think of the long-term consequences of allowing even one vendor to set up shop.
Gold Rush, Party Time, Oak Keg, be out here next. Mm-hmm. We so okay to this one, we're going to have competition. They're going to do the same business model out here. So we're opening Pandora's box on an issue that the community said, we don't want that box open.
The council voted 6-1 to protest any liquor license application that comes forward from the Brown Jug. The protest carries some significant weight. The state's Assistant Attorney General John Novak issued an opinion that the city's protest is enough to compel the ABC board to deny any application that would come forward. The ABC board could address it at their next quarterly meeting. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a study to see if fishing observers can be replaced by electronics.
There's a lot of fishing situations where an extra person on board just isn't going to be workable or is going to force us to leave a crew member on the beach and cost a job.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
The House is poised to vote on its $3.1 billion capital budget this evening, and the Senate is waiting for it. If the Senate accepts the $300 million in expenses the House Finance Committee approved this afternoon, the special legislative session will have reached a point where adjournment could occur later tonight or tomorrow. If issues remain unresolved, the bill will go to a conference committee for discussion. The Senate today passed and sent to the House its version of a bill extending and making changes to the state's coastal management program that helps coordinate state, federal, and local requirements for development projects. The bill on the floor had been changed from what the House sent to the Senate to reflect negotiations between coastal communities and the Parnell administration. One of the major changes to the House bill would take away the governor's right to remove, at will, members from the Coastal Policy Board. They could only be removed for cause. Gallivan Democrat Donnie Olson said it gives more power to local residents.
This policy board is not a regulatory board. It's just a board of people that are put together to try and give people, local people, the ability to go and voice their concerns. That's the reason the removal of a public member was changed in the Senate Finance Committee.
By a 17-20 vote, the House refused to accept the Senate version. The Senate refused to recede from its version, and the bill has been assigned to a conference committee that is scheduled to meet tomorrow morning. A decision there will have to be reached quickly, as it will be up against legislators' desire to adjourn the special session. The governor has said he will not support the Senate version of the bill. A fisheries trade association is spearheading research to determine if it's practical to monitor bycatch electronically on some longliners rather than using human observers. The Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association has been awarded a $220,000 grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to study whether cameras can do the job when new rules go into effect requiring observers on all groundfish vessels over 40 feet long. This is on top of research Alpha is involved in to find ways to keep sperm whales away from longline gear. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The writing has been on the wall for over a year now. Onboard observer requirements are moving down into smaller vessels. Actually, Alpha Executive Director Linda Benkin uses a different analogy.
We are sort of staring down the barrel of being required on boats. Everything over 40 feet will now be eligible and at some point tasked with providing observer coverage, either a person that has to go out on your boat or a camera.
Tracking bycatch is federal law, and having human observers is current practice on vessels from 60 to 125 feet, which have to have observer coverage on one-third of their fishing days. Everything over 125 feet has to have 100% coverage. 40 feet is another matter. Dan Falvey, longlines in Sitka from a 47-foot boat.
There's a lot of fishing situations where an extra person on board just isn't going to be workable or is going to force us to leave a crew member on the beach and cost a job. And no one wanted that.
Falvey says the International Pacific Halibut Commission conducted an experiment last year that proved camera coverage was just as effective in monitoring bycatch as human observers. But the test was derailed by equipment problems with the cameras and seasickness among the people. Alpha will use the $220,000 over 2 years. This summer's task is finding a camera and recording system that will hold up at sea. Next summer, Falvey says Alpha will collaborate with the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association and the Southeast Fishermen's Alliance to run a full-scale pilot project on at least 12 boats.
Our job here is to find a way to engage the stakeholders, the fishermen all across Alaska, to develop electronic monitoring that'll work on our boats and is compatible with the systems we have. And then also to test ways of rotating it amongst the boats so it can be done in a cost-effective manner now that we all have to pay for it.
The Federal Observer Program will be funded by a 1.25% levy on groundfish vessels, regardless of size, beginning in 2013. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Togiak Sacro herring fishery has been open since Sunday, but it wasn't until just yesterday that fishermen began harvesting large amounts of herring. KDLG's Mike Mason has this update.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has finally reported a harvest of herring as part of the annual Togiak Sacro herring fishery. Through the end of Wednesday, Persane fishermen harvested just 780 tons of herring on 11 deliveries. Through that same period, gillnet fishermen harvested just 120 tons from 19 deliveries. That's 900 tons all told. That is well below the 24.8 thousand tons of herring available for commercial harvest this year. The fisheries under the management of Alaska Department of Fish and Game Area Management Biologist Tim Sands, who noted that all of the processors were buying fish Thursday, and he anticipated a large increase in the commercial harvest after the slow start. The gillnet fishery is currently open until further notice, and Sands issued an announcement Thursday extending the purse seine fishery through 10 p.m. Saturday. Sands says limiting the purse seine fishery will help him stay within the 70-30 split between the purse seine and gillnet fleets.
We do have an allocation plan. We want to keep the allocation on track in season. I wanted to make sure that we still had control of the allocation without going. So that's why I cut it down by 24 hours, just to 48 hours.
Sands confirms that he's trying to keep his options open just in case he needs to give the purse seine fishermen a break in order to stay within that 70-30 allocation split.
I don't really anticipate that. I mean, the weather seems like it's good, so I don't see why we'd do that, but we want to keep our options open.
During his survey flight Thursday, Sands counted about 23 gillnet vessels and around 20 seiners on the fishing grounds.
Those aren't necessarily final numbers. I know that there's people still on their way over there.
Sand says he anticipates trying to document spawn during a flight and will try and document peak biomass during a survey flight Sunday. There are currently 6 seafood processing companies registered to buy fish. Sand says the herring biomass is pretty spread out throughout the Togiak district.
We saw fish pretty much everywhere along the way. There was fish. We didn't see a massive school in Togiak Bay, but there were definitely schools of fish in Togiak Bay, and there were a lot of really long strings or ribbons of fish spread out along the beach. There were miles and miles of narrow bands of fish strung out.
The average weight of the herring harvested so far in the purse seine fishery is 368 grams, and the roe percentage is 6%. The herring harvested by gillnetters are larger, coming in on average at 423 grams. The gillnet fish also have a higher roe percentage of 9.3%. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Several Alaska Native groups are suing the federal government over the designation of habitat for threatened polar bears. Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, the North Slope Borough, and others filed the lawsuit today against the Department of the Interior and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The plaintiffs say the designation will not address the primary threat to polar bears, which is the loss of sea ice due to climate change. The federal government has designated more than 187,000 square miles as polar bear habitat. Federal scientists and the Coast Guard are looking for a whale entangled in fishing gear near Juneau. The humpback was first seen outside Auk Bay on Wednesday by a Gastineau guiding tour operator. Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologists spotted it later that day near the southeast tip of Shelter Island while conducting a herring survey. The whale did not appear to be in distress, says National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration spokeswoman Julie Spiegel.
Traveling slowly, but that's not unusual. It was traveling west with a big yellow buoy trailing behind it about 5 to 8 feet. It was coming up to breathe about every 3 minutes, but those situations can change rapidly.
NOAA scientists and law enforcement, along with the Coast Guard, are looking for the whale to determine if the entanglement is life-threatening. The animal hasn't been seen since Wednesday.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
An aide to Senator Mark Begich says he will view post-mortem photographs of Osama bin Laden taken after the al-Qaeda leader was killed May 2nd by a Navy SEAL team in Pakistan. As a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Begich is among members of Congress with access to the images. The Obama administration has declined to publicly release the photos, saying the images could incite violence or be used as a propaganda tool. Begich spokeswoman Julie Haskett says Begich does not doubt the terrorist leader is dead, but feels it's his duty to view the photos as an Armed Services Committee member. Yesterday's Arctic Council meeting in Greenland was a historic one, not only because it signed off on its first binding agreement in 17 years, but also because it was the first time that a Secretary of State and a member of Congress, Senator Lisa Murkowski, attended the meeting. Murkowski saw this as an encouraging sign of the U.S.'s role in the Arctic.
But I think as we are seeing changes in an evolving Arctic and more eyes turned north, I think you will get more people in this country who recognize that that there are opportunities, whether it be for commerce or whether it be for resource development or whether it be for tourism.
Murkowski says that while it's difficult to convince others in Congress that America is indeed an Arctic nation, the U.S. must shoulder the responsibilities that come with it. But with the geography and climate of the Arctic changing so quickly, the process of educating others about these issues will come easier.
But I think as we are seeing changes in an evolving Arctic and more eyes turned north, I think you will get more people in this country who recognize that there are opportunities, whether it be for commerce or whether it be for resource development or whether it be for tourism.
The agreement that the Council signed is an international arrangement laying out search and rescue regions in the Arctic. Alaska Native leaders gathered in Washington this week to advocate for the legal empowerment of the world's indigenous peoples. The summit took place in the seat of Washington, D.C. Power, the chambers of the Senate Appropriations Committee. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The fight for rights of Native people happens the world over, but activists say it often happens in isolation, in one community or one country. Members of the Alaska Federation of Natives want to expand the power of Indigenous people by unifying with others outside of Alaska. The conference was the brainchild of AFN leaders who've been working across boundaries with a Peruvian group, the Institute for Liberty and Democracy. That group started 30 years ago to help the poor of Peru gain legal rights and a foothold in the economy. AFN head Julie Kitka invited them and Native Hawaiian and Lower 48 leaders to the meeting, which she says was the first step to building a new campaign.
To develop both an international and a domestic framework for a change in U.S. policy dealing with Native American and Indigenous issues. And so it was the first baby step on pulling together a lot of potential partners to talk about the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, talk about current U.S. policy, and see if there's interest in people, you know, working together, building a network of people that want to strengthen the United States and build better futures for our kids.
The real coup was where the meeting was held, in the U.S. Capitol's Senate Appropriations Chamber.
This is a seat of power, seat of the government. Very, very visual reminder to people that Native Americans, Indigenous people don't have to be ignored and marginalized, that they can be right in the center of our government, at least for a little bit of time, and have their issues and concerns be listened to as well. So it was a symbolic thing.
Kitka worked with Senator Dan Inouye of Hawaii, the head of Appropriations, who extended the invitation. Other members of Congress from Hawaii and Alaska came, as did representatives of the Obama administration. the room was full of Alaskans, and others were eager to hear from them about all they've learned about fighting for rights. Robin Danner, with the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement, says the Alaskans are decades ahead of other tribal groups in their journey.
I think many Alaska Natives or Alaskans perhaps take for granted the 40 years of travel, of journey that you folks have done together, and those of us outside watching are just amazed. And so I think that one of the examples is exactly the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, those things that were good for the state and those things perhaps that could have been made better.
Danner and others wanted to hear about Alaska Natives' use of corporations and how they're still fighting for hunting and fishing rights. But the Alaskans were there to learn, too. Bobby Quintavel is an Inupiaq leader and the former president of Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. She traveled to Peru in 2009 to meet with indigenous activists and says her eyes were opened to how the corporations and tribes could better partner with community foundations to work on cultural and social goals.
In our discussions, we talked about that as being part of the missing structure inside of ANCSA. How do we really take self-determination to another level and own it?
Quintavel says they're talking about how better coalitions could put to use the knowledge and experience of Alaskans and get money and muscle behind it so that problems can be faced in the community instead of relying on outsiders.
Let's take suicide as an example. The suicide rate in rural Alaska is extremely high. So how do we find the solution to help us address that? Rather than having a program that's designed and developed in Los Angeles for an urban area, and the dollars only being eligible to be spent in that space because you have to have running water, you got to meet all these health standards, all of these issues. How can we get around that? And it's through these community foundation partnerships.
Organizers left the conference saying now that some bridges have been built, they need to follow up and partner together. In the U.S., they want to support each other, whether it's fighting for subsistence rights or finding private foundations interested in investing in projects. On the international level, they want to see cultural exchanges between indigenous groups like the one with Peru. And they want to be involved in how the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is actually implemented and want to see funding put behind it. President Obama pledged last fall to sign on to it, but just how the Declaration can change people's lives throughout the world remains to be seen. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes and Shane Iverson in Bethel, Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Josh Esch. Edge from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.